It's Monday, April 19th, and one of the most consequential police trials in a generation is about to go to the jury. We start here. Minneapolis, along with the rest of the country, braces for closing arguments in the case of Derek Chauvin.
I really do not believe we'll see an acquittal in this.
What trial lawyers are expecting from the attorneys and the jurors is the type of mass shooting that would spark calls for red flag laws, but Indiana already has red flag laws.
You never think it's going to hit so close to home until it comes and slaps you in the face.
After devastating revelations this weekend, residents want to know who dropped the ball. And he almost died last time he was in Russia, so how's he doing now?
They're saying that if nothing is done, he could die within days.
Vladimir Putin's most vocal opponent is on the brink of becoming a martyr. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. If you want a sense of the vibe in Minneapolis right now, consider what happened this weekend. Remember, everyone was focused on the death of George Floyd, the footage of him dying, when we suddenly saw footage of another young black man killed by police, Dante Wright, in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota. That sparked its own outcry. Well, then, footage emerged of a 13-year-old boy in Chicago.
A nearby security camera capturing the tense final moments of the teen's life as he allegedly tosses the handgun behind a wooden fence before seeming to surrender, hands appearing to be empty and in the air as Officer Stillman shoots him in the chest.
Says
nine!
We're gonna wake this community up!
Which brings me back to this weekend. First, a neighborhood in California woke to a commotion as a pig's head was found dropped off at the front door of a home. This was the former home of a police officer. He didn't live there anymore, but he had just testified for the defense in the Derek Chauvin murder trial. Then, early yesterday morning, Minnesota police reported that someone had just driven past a group of uniformed police and National Guardsmen in open fire.
The guard says the gunshots came from a white SUV towards a Minnesota National Guard and Minneapolis police team providing neighborhood security in that area.
Minneapolis is a city on edge this morning, and by the end of the day, you could theoretically have a verdict in the case of Derek Chauvin. Closing arguments begin this morning. The jury is expected to start deliberating, perhaps by this afternoon. So I've told you what it's like outside the courtroom. Let's discuss what it'll be like inside. We're joined now by Shauna Lloyd. She's an attorney for the Cochran firm in Orlando, Florida. She's also an ABC News contributor. And Shauna, I'm wondering, you're a trial lawyer, right? What do you think we're going to be seeing today from both sides? Prosecution, defense, what are the game plans here?
I think with the state, the prosecution, they're going to be giving you a summation, right? You're going to see them go through every highlight of their case, every highlight of every expert, and they're going to be reminding the jury of that.
Do you have an opinion as to when the restraint of Mr. Floyd should have ended in this encounter?
Yes.
What is it?
When Mr. Floyd was no longer offering up any resistance to the officers, they could have ended the restraint.
What they want to do is remind the jury that there is no reasonable doubt. We've gone over every possible item that could have contributed to death and ruled it out.
What today remains your opinion as to the cause of death for Mr. Floyd?
So my opinion remains unchanged. It's what I put on the death certificate last June. That's cardiopulmonary arrest complicating law enforcement subdual restraint and neck compression. That was my top line then. It would stay my top line now.
The use of force is not attractive, but it is a necessary component of policing.
For the defense, what you're going to see is they're going to highlight every alternative method that could have been the cause of death, whether it's the drugs, whether it's the carbon monoxide. You're going to see them go back to those points so that way it reminds a jury that, hey, wait a second, there were these alternative causes of death.
It was your belief that Mr. Floyd started using again about 2 weeks prior to his death, correct?
I noticed a change in his behavior, yes.
Well, at this point, if you're one of the lawyers, right, you've got what you've got, right? Like, you can't go back and introduce new testimony or new evidence or like even new angles for the jury. So are there spots at this point where you're like, sorry, like, you just didn't bring it hard enough during testimony, so there's no way you're going to get a jury on board with that particular thing now.
Absolutely. I mean, we saw that with the carbon monoxide, right? They actually have the percentages, but they cannot introduce that because the only thing that they can bring in this summation is everything we've already seen. Mm. So things like that are things that the jury may have a question for, but they cannot bring that into their closing arguments. Otherwise, that can create a mistrial. That's why that issue is treated so delicately. So we're going to see them just give a summation of every expert and every point that was given during this trial.
Great. And then do you I don't want to put you on the spot with a prediction, but, like, you know, barring a big surprise in these closing arguments, do you have an idea of which way this jury must be leaning at this point based on the testimony you've seen?
You know, jurors are so unpredictable. So let me start by saying that the one time you say never is that's exactly what they're going to do. I really do not believe we'll see an acquittal in this. I think that you're going to see a lot of deliberation about which charge they may decide on. Unless we have a holdout.
Really? Like an acquittal in your, a 12-0 acquittal in your mind is not really at the top of your
menu.
I
don't think that's at the top. Not looking at the cases the way they were presented. And in these types of cases, I actually usually find acquittals very high on the list, especially when you're talking about law enforcement. But in this case particularly, I do not see an acquittal being very high on the list. I see a longer deliberation about the charges because one thing jurors like to do is get the law right. They take their responsibility very seriously and they work really hard to come up with the right outcome based on the law that they're given.
Chauvin facing charges of second-degree unintentional murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter. He has pleaded not guilty.
The murder two charge is going to require that he was committing an underlying felony. The underlying felony is aggravated assault. This means he intended to cause substantial bodily harm. That does have an intent, so he intended to cause the grave bodily harm. Then they can find him guilty of the murder two, which does not actually require in and of itself intent. Murder three is that you were doing something that was reckless to others, including the person that you killed. So reckless is right above negligence. So it means that you had some thought that what you were doing could have been very dangerous. The manslaughter just means that you were doing something that you knew had some level of danger to it and that you engaged in that behavior anyway.
Derek Chauvin did exactly what he had been trained to do over the course of his 19-year career.
It's been nights. I stayed up apologizing and apologizing to George Floyd for not doing more.
I see them deliberating over those charges extensively because each one has a different measure that the state would have to prove in and a certain level of what his action fell under. Was it reckless? Mm. Was it just casual disregard? You know, those are the things that I think that they're going to be deliberating about.
Yeah, which to your point about jurors wanting to get the law right, that is often one of the questions we hear juries ask the judge during the deliberation process. They come in and they ask the judge to repeat the exact wording of the law to see whether the evidence supports that particular offense. A lot at stake later today. Shauna Lloyd, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Next up on Start Here, he was the guy who red flag laws are supposed to protect you from. So what went wrong? We go to Indianapolis after the break. With daylight saving time upon us, we're looking forward to more daylight and longer days from March through November, and while setting our clocks forward gives us the illusion of more time, it doesn't necessarily help businesses find qualified candidates any sooner. Fear not, there is a solution. ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter is your 24/7 hiring partner working tirelessly to connect you with the right candidate. Once you post your job on ZipRecruiter, it gets distributed to over 100 job sites, ensuring you reach a diverse pool of qualified individuals. Their smart technology scans thousands of resumes, matching you with people whose skills perfectly align with your job requirements. Spring forward with a new hiring partner, ZipRecruiter, and find top talent sooner. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free, ZipRecruiter.com/start here. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/start here. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
One of the most ominous feelings to come out of the mass shooting at a series of Atlanta spas earlier this year was, this is an epidemic that we're used to, and it's back.
This is the man police say killed three people in the Arboretum area today.
Over the weekend, we had several more mass shootings.
The Kenosha County Sheriff says three male victims are dead. Two more people are seriously injured in what is believed to have been a targeted shooting at what appears to have been a crowded bar last night.
And meanwhile, the city of Indianapolis is still reeling from a shooting that killed eight people last Thursday.
We are learning more about, sadly, the newest mass shooting in America, about the suspect, a former employee who showed up at that FedEx facility in Indianapolis, opening fire, and in just 1 to 2 minutes, taking the lives of eight people.
But if all these stories make you wonder about the availability of guns and whether perhaps more states should institute so-called red flag laws, Indiana has red flag laws. The suspect had apparently been subject to them, and yet he was allegedly still able to buy new guns. Let's go to ABC's Will Carr, who's been on the scene all weekend. And first of all, Will, can you just get us up to speed on how this all played out? At this point, what do we know about the shooting itself?
Yeah, Brad, here we are again. I was just in Boulder, Colorado, where 10 people were killed. Now we're in Indianapolis. The alleged shooter used to work at this FedEx hub, which is one of the largest in the world. He worked there last year, and authorities say that he showed up around 11 o'clock Thursday night, and he allegedly started shooting, killing four people in the parking lot with two assault rifles, and then he shifted inside and killed four more people before he ultimately took his own life.
Like, we always read about all these mass shootings that are happening. You never think it's going to hit so close to home until it comes and slaps you in the face. And that's exactly what happened.
Once again, we're having a mass shooting. We're trying to figure out why, and eight more innocent lives have been taken.
Well, and so we talk about red flag laws, Will, and this guy, it sounded like he's the guy you talk about when you talk about red flag laws. So where did he get a gun? How did this happen?
Yeah, so this is very complicated and intricate, but let's start with Indiana. It does have a red flag law that essentially bars anybody legally deemed to be dangerous from buying or even owning or even borrowing a gun. So this suspect last year, last March, his mom contacted local police here in Indianapolis, and she said, hey, I'm really worried about my son. In fact, I'm so worried, and this is according to authorities, she said, I'm so worried, I'm concerned that he's going to commit suicide by cop. That's what authorities say she told them. So what happens is the local police go to his house, and they, according to the police chief, this is what he just told me, they decided he was dangerous, and he was dangerous enough to take a shotgun away from him.
Oh, like they took away, like this is not, we're not going to let you have guns from here on. Like they took away the gun he had already.
That's right. He had a shotgun. They took it away from him. They also put him on a temporary mental health hold. Since the shotgun was taken away from him last year, the question now is, why was he not funneled into the red flag system?
We don't really know at this point, but it has to go through a court proceeding in order to get those charges filed. And for some reason,
that
didn't happen. I don't believe he went to court now.
We talked to the police chief. We asked him that question, and he says, look, what should have happened is we took the gun from him, and then it should have been referred to the court system. And the way this works is if Indiana takes your gun, you have 14 days to petition the court system to get your gun back. If the court decides that you are a danger to either yourself or your community, then they can keep your gun or guns for up to 6 months, and then you have the chance to go back and petition again, and then the burden of evidence actually falls on law enforcement to prove that you are still dangerous. Apparently, none of that happened in this case. What happened next is really unclear. The police chief tells me they're trying to figure out if this was put into the court system or not. At this point, he says they simply don't know.
Let's say everything proceeded as it should and he didn't get that violation from the red flag law. I don't think we have enough information out there from reports that would just bring your attention to concerns.
But members of the local community here, especially the victim's family members, are telling me they really feel like the ball was dropped here.
Well, and the majority of the victims in the Atlanta shootings, right, were of Asian descent. Half of these victims, 4 out of the 8 deaths here, were members of the Sikh community. It's predominantly South Asian. How is that local community responding? How is Indianapolis responding to this?
The members of the Sikh community are just absolutely devastated, and they're the ones who are telling me they really want accountability here.
There's 8 victims, but 8 families that are grieving. When one of our own passes away, the whole Sikh community grieves with them.
Outside of that community, though, it's really unique and interesting from my perspective. And I've covered a lot of mass shootings. Like I mentioned, I was just in Boulder, Colorado not too long ago. At the crime scene in the surrounding area, we haven't seen a single flower. We haven't seen a single memorial. And it really is business as usual in that area around the crime scene. And I've been talking to people who live around here, and one thing that we should definitely notice, this is Indianapolis's 3rd mass shooting, a mass shooting being defined as 4 more people killed, not including the gunman. This is Indianapolis's 3rd mass shooting this year alone. So, you know, these shootings are happening so fast that I think it's a blur to a lot of people.
Like they don't care about these victims or this place, but just like there's been so much death in general.
Exactly. I mean, in the last month, think about it. You had Georgia, South Carolina, Colorado, Southern California. But specifically here in this local community in Indianapolis, they have had 3 this year. And so when I'm talking to people who live here, they're telling me that they are just numb to the violence at this point.
Wow, that's great perspective. Sad perspective, but really useful. All right, Will Carr, there in Indianapolis. Thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
Where there's an interest in the United States to work with Russia, we should and we will. Where Russia seeks to violate the interests of the United States, we will respond. We'll always stand in defense of our country, our institutions, our people, and our allies.
We talked last week about President Biden's new sanctions against Russia and what some see as the escalating threat there. And from a foreign perspective, it often seems like world leaders are just doing their thing. We forget that just like here, they're often responding to domestic politics, pressure from their own supporters and opponents. Well, if Vladimir Putin has anyone who could really be considered a viable political opponent, it's Alexei Navalny.
Navalny fell violently ill on his flight to Moscow. Passengers recording the sound of his moaning. Before Navalny was rushed to the hospital after an emergency landing.
Remember, this was the activist who was apparently poisoned as he got on a flight. He nearly died. He recovered enough in Germany to decide that he's going back to Russia. Well, now he may once again be on the brink of dying, this time in Russian custody. Let's go to ABC senior foreign correspondent Ian Pannell. Ian, do I have all that right? Because if I do, how would that not be construed as yet another assassination attempt against Putin's biggest political opponent?
Oh, well, I don't think you're the only one asking that question, Brad. I certainly think Alexei Navalny's supporters and his team are saying just that, that he is being allowed to die. They're saying that his life hangs by a thread, effectively, by a hair.
Extremalных решений. Мы объявляем митинг сейчас.
They're saying that if nothing is done, he could die within days. The man has dangerously high potassium levels that could lead to heart failure. He also has other severe clinical issues which could lead to liver failure. They think if he doesn't get external medical treatment from their own doctors, which apparently is allowed for under the Russian penal code, then yes, indeed, in a matter of days, he could die. And they are calling for mass demonstrations this coming week, this coming Wednesday, to show support. And people are watching.
We have communicated to the Russian government that what happens to Mr. Navalny in their custody is their responsibility, and they will be held accountable by the international community.
Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor on the Sunday shows, making it very clear that there would be consequences if Alexei Navalny was allowed to die.
So you know Vladimir Putin, you think he's a killer?
Mm-hmm.
I do.
And so don't forget that President Biden is also on the record recently calling Vladimir Putin a killer. This is a high-stakes situation here for Alexei Navalny above all, but also for the relationship between Russia and the outside world, in particular the relatively new Biden administration.
But how does this happen? How does, like, one day he just had these elevated potassium levels? I mean, is this another poisoning thing? Is this something else? Is just a sick guy being allowed to die? What are we talking about?
Yeah, I mean, a good question. Look, we need to make it clear. He has been on a hunger strike for 20 days now.
Navalny started refusing food in protest on March 31st after accusing prison authorities of refusing to properly treat acute back and leg pain.
That obviously can have a severe effect on things like potassium levels and can affect your liver, and it depends whether he's accepting liquids or not. These are some of the classic symptoms. Now, people often go much longer on hunger strikes without having these such dire symptoms, but of course he's a man whose life was only just saved having been poisoned with a chemical nerve agent Novichok.
It's something really scary with the people just drop dead without, there are no gun, there are no shots, and in a couple of hours you will be dead and without any traces on your body. It's something terrifying, and Putin is enjoying it.
The finger of blame was pointed very clearly at the Kremlin and the Russian government, something that it has consistently denied. But people are saying, well, hang around, not everyone can get their hands on this stuff. So he's a man whose body is weakened.
Why isn't Alexei Navalny, now a prisoner in Russia, allowed to see his own doctor?
Navalny has been treated in the hospital, which lies not so far from the place where he is serving his sentence. And as I understand, he does not complain anymore.
I think he does complain, and his personal doctor was rebuffed when she tried to see him.
What happens if Alexei Navalny dies, Ian? I mean, Vladimir Putin is so powerful that I can't imagine just all of a sudden a revolution overtakes him. But are there risks here?
Yes, I mean, there are severe risks, and you know, the consequences could be dire. We already saw when he came back to the country and he was immediately arrested, widespread demonstrations and violence across Russia.
But 2 months on, the Kremlin has regained control. It has smothered the protests with repression.
It will be a test of the level of support and the risks that people are willing to take, how many come out onto the streets on Wednesday. But the Russian government's made it clear that it won't tolerate public dissent of that kind. It will crack down. Arrests have been made. People have been threatened. In fact, one of the many groups that support Alexei Navalny is now, there's now an attempt to try and outlaw it. But yeah, there will be a big reaction.
Right. If we're talking about risks and consequences, there's another thing happening in Russia right now. That is reports of troops piling up along the border with Ukraine, sending this warning to the Ukrainians. Hey, watch what you do with Western countries, whether it's trying to get into NATO or whatever. We own this region. That is the unmistakable message. Whether they will act on that threat with all these troops, with all this gear, that remains to be seen. Ian Pannell, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Brad.
All right, let's take a breather. Actually, maybe we should take a stretch as well. One last thing is next. And one last thing. They took off during the pandemic. Well, now they're just trying to head off investor panic.
Peloton, come on. Let's get this workout started.
Peloton is known for making stationary exercise bikes, but in recent years, they've actually expanded to lots of exercise stuff. Treadmills, workout classes, the whole pitch is you get the experience of a big workout class at home.
Heart rate stays up. We're moving to the mat. Let's go, Peloton. Bring that thunder.
Of course, profits exploded during the pandemic, but now a federal agency is loudly telling people with children at home not to use Peloton's most popular treadmill.
After 39 incidents of objects, a pet, and most of all, children being sucked under this device, we believe that the public health and safety requires this warning.
So here's what happened. A month ago, Peloton revealed that multiple children had been injured in connection to its running treadmill. They call it the Tread Plus. In fact, one child died. There's actually home security footage showing a child getting his hand stuck in the back of a treadmill. You know, as the top of the belt, the thing you run on, is going backwards, you're running on it. Well, on the underside, of course, it's being pulled back to the front, and that can pull a kid's hands with it, or a pet. The Consumer Product Safety Commission is now telling parents not to use it unless they can keep it in a locked room. And that's where this story gets interesting. Because while 20,000 children go to the emergency room every year after treadmill accidents, this is not usually how it plays out. Usually, if something's wrong, the CPSC tells a company, hey, you should issue a recall. It's tough for them to force one, but if you're the company, you might be thinking, oof, like, just imagine how bad the press would be if we ignored this.
Peloton CEO John Foley sending an email to members saying in part, I can't tell you how much this news and horrible reality has hit me personally and our entire team at Peloton.
But Peloton here is saying, no. This is not an issue that a recall will fix. In a public statement, they said the Tread Plus is safe and that the real issue is people not following the instructions. Quote, the Tread Plus is not for children under 16. Peloton warns members to keep children, pets, and objects away from the Tread Plus at all times. To which safety advocates and the federal government are saying, okay, like, good luck keeping children and pets away from anything on the floor at all times. Well, now it's clear the agency has gone nuclear and issued this warning, along with a link to a terrifying video of a kid being sucked under. It's literally the first thing you see on their webpage. And this has raised a question for any company that has watched profits skyrocket in this last year. Do business booms have a finish line? And if they do, are you willing to sprint past the government as this pandemic runs its course? Such a bizarre back and forth here. In the meantime, government has nothing to say about Peloton's other products. Peloton says that warning is inaccurate and misleading. ABC News will have live coverage of the closing arguments in the Derek Chauvin trial today. That starts at 10 a.m. Eastern. More on abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.